TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Paul Cienfuegos, Community Rights versus Corporate Rights.
I didn't learn in high school that the American Revolution was specifically an anti-corporate rule revolution. The 13 colonies were crown corporations, chartered by the monarch, or controlled by crown corporations. The Pennsylvania Company, after the revolution, it is constitutionalized and it becomes the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, it becomes a state. The Massachusetts Bay Company, constitutionalized and becomes the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So the American Revolution takes this oppressive structure of the Crown Corporation and constitutionalizes it as something which is now below us, right? The state is there to serve us, and corporations are now redefined, which are here to serve us.
This was just one of the surprising statements in Paul Cienfuegos' talk about the history of corporate rights in the first part of this program. However, as Cienfuegos went on to explain, in the intervening 220-plus years, corporations in America have moved from subordinate position to become the dominant institution in society, much of it due to U.S. Supreme Court decisions. Given their overwhelming power today, it is hard to believe that right after the American Revolution, corporations were not allowed to own or merge with another corporation, were not allowed to own land beyond what is necessary to fulfill the nature of their charter, were not allowed to participate in the electoral process at all, and their directors and stockholders were held personally liable for all harms and debts. All this was explained in detail in the first part of this talk. Paul Cienfuegos is a workshop leader, lecturer, and writer. In 1994, Cienfuegos discovered the pioneering work of Richard Grossman and Pokeland, the program on corporations, law, and democracy. That discovery fundamentally transformed Cienfuegos' social change activism. Instead of addressing one issue after another and pleading with corporations to do less harm, he decided to challenge corporate power directly. In 1995, he founded Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County to begin to model a new way of working on issues like clear-cut logging, big-box stores, the weakening of organic food standards, etc. Today, Cienfuegos works closely with CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. This community rights movement aims to protect the health and welfare of the community and of local nature, and it has shown impressive successes. So here is the second half of a brief corporate history in the U.S. told by Paul Cienfuegos, recorded in the Grange Hall in Willits, California, in July 2013. Cienfuegos begins by explaining what New Jersey and Delaware did to attract corporations.
In the 1870s in New Jersey, in the 1880s in Delaware, for the first time in our history, state legislatures passed laws that said to corporate leaders all over the country, please recharter here in New Jersey and then in Delaware, drop your charters wherever you are, because we've redesigned the chartering system from scratch. You're no longer going to be a subordinated institution. You no longer have to follow rules, requirements, prohibitions. You just have to follow state law and you can charter here. New Jersey and Delaware legislation threw out a century, basically, of subordinating language. Poof. By the 1880s, none of that structure of subordination even existed anymore. It was over. Hundreds and hundreds of large corporations shifted their chartering state to New Jersey and Delaware, and it was over. To this day, most giant corporations are chartered in those two states. And it doesn't, you might think, oh, well, so-and-so Monsanto, Exxon, whatever, is headquartered in Texas or whatever, that has nothing to do with where they're chartered. These are totally separate things. Headquartered in Texas, chartered in New Jersey, because that's where the chartering laws are most beneficial to the corporate legal form or legal fiction. Fourth story, the birth of corporate personhood rights, 1886. Supreme Court rules in 1886 in a court case, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad Company. Southern Pacific Railroad is the first truly giant corporation in U.S. history. They controlled most transportation options in this state and extended somewhat into other states as well. Southern Pacific Railroad in Santa Clara County, which is a San Francisco Bay County, the south end of the bay, their lawyers argued in a case that started locally in Santa Clara County that they should not be charged a different property tax rate per acre for their long track lines that they owned for that property, that it was unconstitutional to charge them a different property rate, a higher property rate than the human beings who owned land on the sides of the tracks and everywhere else in the county. That violated their corporate rights under the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which is one of the three amendments that was about freeing slaves and then giving them personhood and voting rights. And again, freeing slaves, that's accurate, but personhood and voting rights, again, to be really accurate, male slaves, right? African men, through those three constitutional amendments, end up with personhood. The 14th Amendment talks about equal protection and due process for all persons. And the corporate lawyers said, aha, surely the founders, those great founding fathers, surely they meant to include the corporation as a person when they wrote the 14th Amendment. And that corporations surely deserve equal protection and due process as well. And the Supreme Court had in it seven retired railroad attorneys. And a court clerk who was a retired railroad attorney did some interesting shenanigans that if you've read Tom Hartman's book, Unequal Protection, probably a few of you have. The story is very bizarre, and I'm not even going to go into it. It's not even absolutely clear what exactly happened. He has one particular interpretation that seems quite likely, but there's various interpretations of what actually happened in that case. But it doesn't actually matter. After 1886, because of the nature of the decision, corporate lawyers worked feverishly to set legal precedent after that case that turns corporate personhood under the 14th Amendment into precedent-setting law. We now have hundreds of cases that in the first few decades after that case set precedent that corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment. And in those first 30 years after that event, 1886, corporate lawyers successfully used the 14th Amendment to argue for corporate personhood 300 times approximately, successfully, and freed male slaves successfully used it about 30 times.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Now, once you get personhood rights, now there's a juicy win, because the word person is all over the amendments to the Constitution. They're all over. So corporations ultimately win First Amendment free speech rights as persons. They win property rights as persons. They win rights against search and seizure as persons. Hundreds of court cases now set on top of that case, and they all say corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment. So if you challenge that one case, you actually don't do anything, other than if you pass, you know, constitutional amendments that strip corporations of their rights. So basically, just to give you just a tiny bit of history about what it means ultimately for corporations to win personhood rights under the amendments to the Constitution, I'll focus just really briefly on property rights and First Amendment free speech rights. So historically, property rights means the stuff, the physical, tangible stuff. It ends up being called tangible property, because all of a sudden there's intangible property under law. And that is what?
Intellectual
property, right? And that becomes a big thing that you can own and make profit over, is intangible or intellectual property. That's the real juicy win for corporate attorneys. Anything you can get a judge to define as property, tangible or not, you now have control over. So the ultimate goodie on this one is that corporations have now won the right, and this is kind of hard to believe or hard to imagine. I'll say it a couple times. Corporations have won the right of pretty much all key economic decision making. The process itself of decision making by a corporate board is now considered an intangible right of a corporate person. So what that means is decisions about what gets produced by a company, where it's produced, how it's produced, is it produced with toxic waste? All of those decisions are now, the decision process itself is a property right of the corporate person. Investment decisions. You're making all these products, you're bringing in lots of profit, what do you get to do with your profit? Those decisions are a corporate property right. And then how work is organized in your corporate institution. Are you employing workers to create real life experience, right? So that they actually learn something relevant and their bodies aren't just worked to death as extensions of a machine? That decision, unions have basically given away in the 1960s and 70s, ultimately, so that we're now at the point that investment, production, and how work is organized is now a property right of the corporate person, right? So no wonder that when decades ago, it hardly happens anymore, but decades ago, if you remember reading in the news on a regular basis, Corporation X has decided to close this factory, the company will shutter its doors and lay off all workers in 12 days. And it's the first the town even has heard of this, right? Please, mayor, do something. Please, governor. Please, president. Please, legislature. I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do. Why? Not just because they were bribed to do nothing. It's that the corporation has protected rights of decision making. It's a corporate right. It's enshrined. Free speech, First Amendment rights, just a brief thing about that. Corporate lawyers have argued successfully for years in the courts that the labels of their products are their speech. So you can't tell them what they can or can't put on a label. And they're building more and more of a case for that. So it's harder and harder to get label, additional information on labeling to happen. They've won cases that say, since we have the right to speak, surely, judge, that means that we have the right to not speak, the right to remain silent. And the judges have agreed with that. Nike Corporation's lawyers argued about 3 or 4 years ago that as a subset of that, they should have the right to deceive. And the Supreme Court tossed it back to the California State Court. Nike Corporation's lawyers were arguing the right of deception in their commercial speech. And it was tossed back to the California courts that didn't decide on that issue either. So it's still up for grabs. Right? So that's for, I mean, I'm giving you just a superficial slice of what all of this means. So those are the four stories. So we end up going from 1819 to the present. This is very much a real life, real time, current story. I started in 1819 in the United States, but everything I'm telling you is still developing. Mm-hmm. Corporations, lawyers are continuing to figure out new ways to keep pushing their rights into more and more elements of society. It's not just that they're paying off politicians, it's that the courts, almost entirely the US Supreme Court, have given them all of these super rights, right? So, you have First Amendment rights to go into your congressperson's office to lobby, right? Monsanto has that same right, okay? That's just the same right. But Monsanto, because of the nature of it as a legal fiction, it can be lobbying every congressperson simultaneously, right? That's not a problem. You have the same First Amendment rights. Right? Which matters more? Right? Which carries more weight? It's obvious, right? So they have all of these rights, but because they're now legal fictions that don't die, their charters were historically 10 to 30 years, and then they were dissolved, and now they last forever, generally, right? Historically, if a corporation caused significant harm or violated its charter, it was dissolved. Its charter was revoked. The legislature didn't plead with the directors or sue them. It charged them with a violation of their charter. They were the subordinate, and they revoked their charter, And remember, a corporation was a state-created fiction. The state brings it into existence, and it has the legal mechanism to pull it away out of existence, right? And still does. That's interestingly enough, states can still revoke corporate charters.
How often have any states actually revoked?
It almost never happens anymore. There was a Republican governor of New York State who, you remember the height of the outrage among the public around the tobacco industry's lies in the, like 15, 20 years ago maybe, I've lost track of exactly when all of the tobacco CEOs were lined up under oath in front of Congress. You remember that moment? It was like really riveting TV. And they finally admit under oath that they've known for decades that cigarettes cause cancer, right, after lying for decades. So at that point, the governor of New York used his charter revocation authority to revoke the charter of their phony nonprofit educational association that was called the Council on Tobacco Research.
Oh, yes.
An educational nonprofit. And he revoked their charter immediately. Right? That's an example of what you would do. But again, that wasn't the companies itself, that was their phony educational nonprofit. They're at what's called an AstroTurf group, right? Instead of a grassroots group. It was a big deal just because nobody had done anything like that in a very long time. But it was still a slap on the wrist. And they got huge fines, if you remember, afterwards. And how did they pay those fines? They massively expanded tobacco sales to teenagers in third world countries. That's how they paid the fines. And the fines, by the way, are tax deductible. Corporate fines are tax deductible. And corporate law, the bills to their attorneys are tax deductible. So we paid the fines, right, to a large degree. So there's the situation we're in. And the last little bit of the history is the birth of regulatory law. We'll give you just one last little insight before I finish with my presentation about how we're stuck as activists now, as concerned citizens. Is starting in the 1880s, the U.S. Attorney General met with the leaders of the railroad corporations in the 1880s. These are the first giant companies in the United States. There was enormous outrage coming from the public about the harms being created by the railroads because they were still running coal through their engines, and unfully combusted material was flying out of the stacks of the engines and causing fires all along the tracks. And again, this is early Industrial Revolution, and the public still understands culturally that corporations that cause harm, you don't just plead with them or sue them, you say you have to stop doing that or we'll revoke your charter. That was a cultural understanding still at the end of the 1800s. It became essential at that point because progress is now defined as industrial growth, right? Expansion as rapidly as possible. That becomes the new definition, again, of the 5% are the definers of progress. So it becomes really essential that harm get shifted out of prohibition and into regulation. Okay? So for the first time in the 1880s, under enormous political pressure from the public across the country, the Attorney General creates a new kind of law called regulatory law, creates the first regulatory agency called the Interstate Commerce Commission, which is designed to look to the public as a bold response to public outrage, but is actually designed to do almost nothing. And I'll just read you a couple paragraphs from this article by Jane Ann Morris. Sheep in wolf's clothing. Notice that's not wolf in sheep's clothing. Richard Olney, President Cleveland's Attorney General, explained to railroad corporation executives that the Interstate Commerce Commission, or ICC, was, quote, to be a sort of barrier between the railroad corporations and the people, unquote. From the early days of the ICC, Charles Adams, president of Union Pacific Railroad, saw what was needed to solve the railroad corporation's problems. Quote, what is desired is something having a good sound, but quite harmless, which will impress the popular mind with the idea that a great deal is being done when in reality very little is intended to be done.
Right.
The public was to be pacified with laws that sounded tough, but placed much discretion in the hands of regulators. Does this sound familiar?
Yeah.
So that's what the regulatory system is. It's really quite extraordinary. The regulatory system was never designed to protect environment or labor rights or anything else. It was designed as a shield to keep the public's outrage as far away and as irrelevant as possible against corporate development. That's actually the history starting in the 1880s. And it worked so well to shield the railroad corporations from public wrath in the latter days of the 1800s that other company executives started demanding regulatory agencies of their own. And those included, for example, insurance, meatpacking, food, banking, and telecommunications, telephone and telegraph. Those were the early additional regulatory agencies. So the laws were written by the industries that were going to be regulated. Why? Well, of course, they're the experts, right? They know what the laws need to say. They're the leading experts in the field. You want to write regulations on logging policy? Well, of course, you need to ask logging companies, because they're the ones who know what modern logging policy should be about. You have concerns about agricultural harm? Well, let's ask the giant agricultural corporations to define agriculture policy, and we'll put that into state and federal regulatory law, and on and on and on. So here we are, post, you know, into the 20th century and now into the beginnings of the 21st century, and for 100 plus years, we the people have been filtered and funneled into single-issue regulatory agencies. Right? Historically, we understood that corporations were not allowed to cause harm. Now, we don't say we're unwilling to allow this corporation to do this thing in our community. We're fighting to lower parts per million. Right? We're outraged that Georgia Pacific is dumping 20 parts per million of mercury out of their pipe into the bay. Right? We demand that the mercury PPM be dropped to 8 parts per million. Right? That's not what a sovereign people does. No. That's what a colonized people does. Right? We the people would say we don't want mercury in the bay. Yeah. We live here, we don't want a poisoned bay. Right? But we don't know how to do that anymore. And we don't, because if you go to a regulatory hearing about logging, about agriculture, about healthcare, about banking, what you find is that that's actually not the agenda in the hearing. The hearing is, we're going to be discussing manure management at the factory farm hearing. Do you have concerns about how we manage the factory farm's manure? That's the only thing you can speak to in your 3 minutes. Everything else won't even be noted because it's not the focus of the regulatory hearing, right? Clear-cut law. You can't go to a logging, you know, we're going to create another timber harvest plan, right, says the state, California Department of Forestry, whatever. You can't go to those hearings and argue that you don't want any of this to happen, that you actually want public control of forest policy, right? Their eyes will just glass over because that's not what the hearing is about, right? It's about a specific obscure regulation. Do you have a comment, please, sir or madam, about that?
Yeah.
Right? That's the system we're in. And it was designed to exclude us. In fact, we can look all the way back to the founding documents of the United States, where James Madison, who's one of the main drafters of the Constitution, or what I now call the Second Constitution, because we actually had another Constitution that was thrown out illegally. That's another story as well. The Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union was actually our first Constitution. But the Second Constitution, the one we all know that exists, James Madison, who was one of the primary drafters, is quoted as saying in the Constitutional Convention meetings, the primary purpose of government is to protect the opulent minority from the majority. Yep. That's the primary drafter of the document said that. Right? They've created a system right from the beginning in the United States that is guaranteed to assure the elite that the 95% has no real power. This is why local communities have no authority, that states overrule local communities on almost everything they want. And Richardson Grove and the bypass are just perfect local examples of that. Right? They're either state agencies telling you what you're going to get, doesn't matter what you want, or corporate leaders doing the same thing. Right? It's still the elite that's deciding for you through this faux democratic process.
Paul Cienfuegos, and how to empower communities to resist the dictates of corporations or of their own state institutions will be the topic of the next program with Paul Cienfuegos on TUC Radio. This one-hour introduction to corporate history brought you some highlights of a longer talk that Cienfuegos presents in his two-day workshops. Cienfuegos has helped create strategies of resistance to corporate power for almost 20 years. Find out more about his work on his website, paulcienfuegos.com. Cienfuegos is spelled C-I-E-N-F-U-E-G-O-S, the Spanish words for 100 fires. Paul Cienfuegos works with CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. He's cooperating with their attorneys and teaching workshops to inspire communities to set and defend their own local rules. He points to CELDEF's impressive record of self-rule that, as of the summer of 2013, includes 150 communities in 9 states. These communities banned corporate fracking, corporate mining, water withdrawal for bottling, urban sewage sludge dumping on farmland, and unsustainable energy production, with many more projects underway right now. This work by CELDEF is the topic of the upcoming program by TUC Radio. So come back when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio has moved to Northern California. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. You can get information on how to order a one-hour CD at cost on tucradio.org or by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. TUC Radio's mailing address is Post Office Box 44, Calpella, California, 95418. That's Calpella, California, 95418. For more information, call 707-463-2654 or go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.